Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Justice Sata.
Good morning. Please be seated. This is the date and time set for the matter of Salata versus the State of Nevada. It's case number 52428. Before we begin, counsel, we did want to make essentially what is a disclosure or a statement of fact, frankly, and that is that the then state public defender, Harriet Cummings, had part, at least something it appears to do, with the drafting of the brief in this case. Of course, Harriet is now our deputy court clerk. She has nothing to do whatsoever with the deliberative or the dispositional process in this case, and we just wanted to make sure that you knew, that we knew, but to ensure that, in fact, that fact had been disclosed. I presume that the state would be the only one who had any concern about that. And we don't believe this is a disqualifying issue at all, but we would like to, that matter to be made a part of our record. Thank you. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Good morning. I'm Carrie Malone from the Public Defender's Office, and I represent David Salata. And I wanted to thank the court for ordering argument in this case. As the court knows, Mr. Salata was convicted of what we call indecent or obscene exposure when he urinated in the parking lot outside the convenience store one night. He is now required to register as a sex offender wherever he goes, and if he fails to do that, he will go to prison. This is simply not what is contemplated by the statutes under these circumstances. NRS 201-220, the statute at issue, makes it a gross misdemeanor for a person who makes any open and indecent or obscene exposure of his person. First of all, the record is clear. There's insufficient evidence present to establish that Mr. Salata committed a sex offense, which 201-220 is. He was possibly intoxicated, standing by his own car in the parking lot, facing the darkness of the desert. The only reason the clerk even saw him is because the clerk peeked through the torn posters on the windows of the store purposely and wanted to see him. The fact that Mr. Salata took longer than Mr. Hunsaker wanted to button up his pants, put his beer down, and get himself together does not convert this simple act of peeing in the parking lot into a sex offense. I submit the case law from this court interpreting the statute makes it clear that a sexual aspect to the prohibited conduct is necessary. We have a list of all the cases. Chiricone, the defendant stepped out onto his front porch pantless just in time for the victim to see him. Young versus State, we have masturbation and oral copulation and a specific statement. It is sufficient that the public sexual conduct or exposure was intentional. State versus Sergeant, masturbating in a car in front of a woman. Berry versus State, during a robbery, the defendant's rubbing the victim, making sexual comments. If he'd known this was going to take so long, he would have had his fun with her, rubbing his genitals against her. State versus Castaneda, intentionally, repeatedly exposing his genitals and buttocks in front of the county jail on the sidewalk. Moreover, other cases from other jurisdictions also reflect the recognition that the intent of an indecent exposure statute is not to cover non-sexual conduct. Nude swimming in Commonwealth versus Conduct from Kaufman from Virginia fits the words of the statute but not the intent. Peeing in the parking lot is a public nuisance in People versus McDonald in California. Nude sunbathing is okay because, again, there's no sexual connotation. Also from California Supreme Court in Ray Smith. And there's simply insufficient evidence in the record that Mr. Salata was engaging in sexualized or suggestive behavior.
Ms. Malone, I think that the court is also particularly interested in the situation that took place at the time of trial with respect to the jury polling and the one juror. Could you address that for us?
Absolutely. I think that in and of itself reflects, again, this need to clarify the statute, because obviously the jury was concerned with this specific issue, and juror number 7 specifically said, you know, I just don't think this is right. It doesn't make sense. He should be acquitted. And as I believe was pointed out in the briefs, The state of Nevada doesn't have a lot of law interpreting this, if any, really. But the other jurisdictions that do interpret or do address how to poll a jury specifically state that the way it was handled here was error and was reversible error. Continuing to poll the jury after the juror has expressed her dissatisfaction is coercive. Having the district attorney comment and question the undecided juror is coercive. The fact that the juror's husband was also on the jury, I submit, is also coercive in this situation. And failing to give the Allen charge is further coercive because all of those things put together fail to reassure that juror that it is okay for her to stick to her guns and say no.
Are you arguing in these cases that it's coercive per se, or is there something in the transcript that the judge said or the questions from the lawyers that made this coercive to the juror when they re-deliberated the case?
I'm actually arguing it's per se.
Why?
Because putting that isolated juror there on the spot, having the DA question her and try to elicit her reasoning and things like that, it puts her immediately on the defense.
What if the judge had said, do you believe that further deliberation might allow the jury to reach a decision in this case? Now, that's often asked in cases where juries have deliberated for extended periods of time,
right. And
there's some uncertainty about whether they are actually hung or whether they can achieve a verdict. Would that be coercive?
No, that specific simple question from
the
judge.
And what's the difference from that question and what occurred here?
Why did you decide what you wanted to decide? What is it you feel? Do you feel like you were being pressured? Both the judge and the DA actually asked questions like that. Are you firm? Are you sure you're firm? You know, several times. Are you really sure? Do you think any more deliberation would help? Could we, you know, will
those
you
kinds
be persuaded of
questions
by the other people to change your mind? Those were the kinds of questions that were asked in this situation. So whether or not actually, I mean, I argue that it is a per se error. But at the same time, in this situation, it was compounded by inherently coercive questioning, is how I. And furthermore, the whole point of the Allen charge is specifically to remind the juror that it is, on the whole jury, to remind everyone that it is, there is no pressure to acquit, I mean to convict. There's, the point is to make it sure they all understand that they have that individual, independent choice, regardless of what everybody else says, to either decide for acquittal or.
Are you suggesting that in every instance in which the polling shows that one or more jurors has dissented, that an Allen charge is required?
When they send them back to re-deliberate? Yes.
In every instance?
Yes. I think it's that big a burden on the court to remind the jurors of their obligations.
I didn't see any cases that mandate that. What would be the form of the opinion if this court resolved the case by published opinion that would compel an Allen charge in every instance in which the court is faced with non-unanimous poll, doesn't ask questions that invade the deliberative process, but sends them back? We're going to ask every juror that's returned to now be subjected to an Allen charge?
I'm not 100% sure I understand your question, except
are we supposed
to, it seems
are,
to be
is
every
this
time
opinion,
you send a jury,
are you asking this court to say that in every instance where the juror is sent back, an Allen charge is going to be given? If so, why?
First of all, I don't think it hurts. We send the jury, every time we release the jury.
What's the legal basis for doing so?
It is simply restating, in effect, the directions to the jury. It's not a burden on the court to do so. It's not a burden on the jurors to hear it again, to understand what the purpose of their deliberation is, and to reestablish each time they go back what they are supposed to be doing in the deliberation room.
Well, aren't there cases that say that the Allen charge itself is inherently coercive?
This court has, approved the Allen charge in Wilkins.
Well, not without some qualifications.
Not without some qualifications. That's true. But again, the court did say the point is of it to clearly inform the jury that each member has a duty to adhere conscientiously to his or her own honest opinion and avoid creating the impression that there's anything improper, questionable, or contrary to good conscience for a juror to create a mistrial. And that is the holding there. So,
of course, Ms. Malone, there's one problem with this, even stepping back from the question that Justice Hardesty is asking, and that is that no one at the time of trial made an objection to the failure to give the Allen instruction or even made a request that it be done.
I recognize that. If I may reserve some time for rebuttal just quickly, I understand that, and I would submit that in this case it's plain error, and the court can look at it from that perspective. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Malone.
Good morning. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Daniel Hoagie, a district attorney for Lincoln County, representing the state of Nevada.
Nice tie, Mr. Hoagie. It must be St. Patrick's Day.
I will be arguing against a per se rule regarding continuation of jury polling and also questioning jurors after polling. Before I get into that, I do want to make a couple comments on the case itself. This case was a simple case, very quick trial. The evidence at trial was that the defendant went with his female roommate to some hot springs in Ash Springs, Nevada, just north of Alamo. After they had spent several hours in the springs, they went across the street to the gas station. He went in to purchase some beers. When he went out, he unzipped his pants, facing the vehicle with one beer in his hand, and showed his penis to this girl roommate who was living with him and sitting in the driver's seat. The state's theory of the case was that he was exposing himself to this girl, his roommate. His theory of the case was that he urinated. He wanted to urinate. The witness from the gas station stated at trial that there was no signs of urination. There was no ever act to urinate. The entire time his hands were up and he was waving his hips. The jury deliberated for approximately 20 minutes. Very quick.
So now I want to argues that this behavior shouldn't result in him becoming a sex offender, which has been the result of this conviction.
I would argue that this is a sex offense.
What granted. About all the cases counsel cites that distinguish this behavior from indecent exposure?
I agree that urination would be distinguished, but the evidence presented seems to suggest that the jury rejected that argument. The jury seems to believe that the defendant was actually exposing himself with a sexual purpose to his roommate, the girl in the driver's seat of the vehicle. And therefore, it would be a gross misdemeanor. It's not something that, as I stated in my brief, you do have to register as a sex offender, but it's not one of those notification offenses. One of those offenses that has to be published. And so it is an offense, but it's the lowest degree of offense. And now I'd like to speak briefly about the polling. As the defense noted in its brief, this court actually reviewed similar issues in White v. State. In White v. State, this court specifically addressed the Brasfield ruling. Now, in the defense's brief and arguments, specifically relies on Spitz, U.S. v. Spitz. Now, Spitz relied on Brasfield. Brasfield was a 1926 United States Supreme Court case. This was before the federal rules of criminal procedure were even enacted. At that time, the court had a supervisory role over the federal courts, and it admitted that later on in its cases. It stated this was not a constitutional ruling. This was a ruling specifically created in its supervisory role. It was a rule of criminal procedure because there were no rules of criminal procedure at that time. And it stated, when you have a deadlocked jury, you should never ask for the numerical division in the jurors. And Spitz took that and extrapolated that to jury polling without any distinction whatsoever. His brief was very, very short. And in fact, this was the minority view. The majority view, from what I could find six cases. This was the sole case that extrapolated that Brasfield ruling to polling. All five other cases rejected that rule. It stated that polling and a poll jury and a deadlock jury are two different things completely. And when you look at it, a deadlocked jury is deadlocked presumably because there are some holdout jurors, obviously. There are some jurors that have decided the issue. They've tried to convince other jurors. The other jurors have tried to convince them, and they are not wavering. They are very resolute. So when those jurors tell the judge what their position is, and the judge says, go back down and deliberate, then that's really coercive upon those minority jurors because they just told the judge that, hey, I'm fixed in my opinion, and the judge said go down and deliberate. The difference with the poll jury is that a poll jury is already decided. They've already given their numerical division to the court. They've already signed the verdict form, sent it up to the judge, and said, we are 12-0. We are 12-0. We've made a decision. And in this case, it was guilty. We've already made up our minds. And then, once the jury gets up to the jury box and the judge, the defense, in most cases, as it was in this case, asks the judge to poll the jury. And at that time, sometimes a jury may change their mind, may waver. Now, in Spitz, the court says, well, you can't continue to poll the other jurors because that would disclose the numerical division. Well, to me, that's faulty reasoning. That's faulty logic because the numerical division was already disclosed. They already knew it was 12-0. So the whole purpose behind polling is to, ironically, find out if a juror was coerced. So if you have one juror that wavers and changes their mind, and then you ask the other jurors, all you're doing is ensuring that there's no further coercion. And ironically, the defense states that this actually coerces that one holdout. And to me, the logic does not make sense. It doesn't add up. Because those jurors have already stated that they vote guilty, 12-0. You have the one juror that says, you know what, I'm changing my mind. I am indecisive. Completely different from a juror that's a holdout, that has been a holdout, and the judge says, go back down.
Counsel, that may be so, but what about what happened in this case where there was, in fact, it was referred to as an evidentiary hearing, where it did seem as if the judge, in this case, may have been invading the deliberative process a bit when he made inquiry of this one juror?
That's why I argue in favor of a totality of the circumstances review. In this case, if you look at all the questions that Judge Dobrescu asked and that defense counsel asked and that I asked, all of the questions were neutral. They were not concocted to persuade. All of the questions were neutral questions, and they were asked principally to find out if there was coercion. So ironically, again, the purpose of the questions and the purpose of this hearing was to find out if there was coercion. And this is acceptable because if you look at NRS 175.531, it states that the judge really has only two options. Send the jury back down to deliberate or declare a mistrial. Now, in those two options, it's really difficult for the judge to make a decision unless he believes that there is potential for further deliberations, and he knows that there is no coercion there. If there's coercion, then obviously a mistrial is appropriate. If there's no coercion, then deliberation would be appropriate. And for the judge to just make a decision without knowing whether there's coercion there for sure or not really makes it difficult. And in fact, there is a similar case in Amos v. United States. This is one of those federal circuit court decisions that were in favor, had a similar situation. The judge continued to ask questions. The judge asked questions, and similar questions to these. They were all, were you coerced? Do you believe you were coerced?
Well, the judge's question on page 172 of the record says, do you need more time to deliberate? Have you fixed your opinion? And that's what it is. And you're not going to deliberate. What are we talking about here? He never says, are you coerced or not coerced? He's asking about her deliberative thought process, and her answer reveals that.
Right.
That I feel, because I'm the only one that doesn't want to go along with them, all that I will probably be sitting there, and they'll get their way anyway, you know. And I just feel the man made a mistake. She's now revealed the deliberative process in which she was engaged as a juror.
Right. Again,
do you think that a test is necessary in this state to guide judges in making the decision between whether to refer them back for further deliberation or ordering a mistrial?
To be honest, it's really difficult in the heat of the moment. Obviously, there's some inertia there when the judge is polling the jury. And in the statute in 175.531, it states the jury shall be polled. And so it kind of assumes that it's the entire jury. And on top of that, the purpose behind it is coercion. So it's difficult to give a bright line rule because every situation is different. And that's why I feel the totality of the circumstances, a review of the totality of the circumstances would be more appropriate. In this case, if you look further in the record, Judge Dobrescu stated on the record, he said, you know what, based on her comportment, based on her attitude, based on everything she said and the interactions with her and the other jurors, I feel like she didn't have enough time to deliberate. I don't think this is a question of coercion. I think she just didn't have enough time to deliberate. Maybe she can go back down there, convince the others, maybe they convince her. And this is what's interesting, too. If you look at which one, it was U.S. v. Fiorilla. In U.S. Fiorilla, it was a very similar situation as well, but there were actually four defendants. The jury came back and said guilty on all four. The judge questioned the juror, or polled the juries, and then one juror said, you know what, I don't agree with that. The judge questioned him, sent him back down to the jury box. And this is what's interesting. In this case, that one lone juror actually convinced 11 others to vote not guilty, to acquit on two of the defendants. And so it is possible. It's not that every situation you can say as a bright line rule, if the judge questions the jury, then it's absolutely coercion. Because in this case, you can see in Fiorilla, the juror actually won over in the end. He convinced the other 11 to acquit. If the judge would have declared a mistrial right at that time because of a bright line rule, those two would not have been acquitted. They would have had to suffer through another trial.
But there's nothing in the statute that allows a judge to hold an evidentiary hearing or get into that deliberative process with these jurors. It's fairly simple. He's got two options. you send them back down to deliberate, or you declare a mistrial.
I agree.
I mean, the statute is a bright line.
Well, I agree to a point. And in a lot of the cases, if you read through the cases, they state that there is no third option. You hear that a lot. But if you look at those cases and where they say there is no third option, this is typically what happens. The judge looks to the jury box, polls the jury, and then one juror notes some indecisiveness. The judge then proceeds to demand a categorical response. Well, is it guilty or not guilty? And then they finally say, okay, guilty. And then the judge accepts the verdict. That's the real third option. Questioning, and what was the case? There is a case in here. I'm short on time. But there is a case in here that says the questioning is not the dispositive act. The questioning isn't the third option. Questioning is a precursor for option one or two. The third option is...
Yeah, but the question in this case, and I think the question in the case you're referring to, is the extent to which the question should go.
Right.
Shouldn't the judge simply be limited to the question, do you feel further deliberations will allow you to resolve this uncertainty and achieve a unanimous verdict? Because the question between further deliberation and a mistrial is they can either resolve their uncertainty or they're hung. Questions that invade the deliberative process would seem to be inherently coercive.
I would agree that there are some questions that could be coercive. But the state of bright line rule and say you can only ask...
Well, you know, the problem with this is the more you ask, the more the uninitiated juror offers up because they think they need to respond to the judge. I mean, they respect the judge. They are concerned about the process. There's a lot of pressure, especially on someone who has dissented. And so if the judge asks some open-ended question, the juror is most likely going to start talking about the deliberative process. They don't know they're not supposed to do that.
And the distinction I would make there is that invading the deliberative process is wrong insofar as it's coercive. And I agree with you if it is coercive. But to say that every question, absolutely, beyond some single question is coercive, I think that takes away from the discretion of the trial judge. They are there in the heat of the moment. They are the ones that see the comportment of the jurors. They're the ones that had heard all of the evidence. They're the ones that are most apt and able to decide whether or not something is coercive or not. And in this case, Judge DeBrescu expressly stated that he felt like the juror just needed more time. I feel that, in closing, the best review is one that gives the judge some discretion in this situation. It's a difficult situation. And that judge, Judge DeBrescu, for example, is in the best position. And in this case, there was no coercion. He found no coercion. And I ask that this court affirm his decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hoge. Ms. Miller.
Thank you. I'd just like to bring the discussion back to this case and whether the court decides to go with a bright line rule argument or not, totality of the circumstances. Under the facts of this case, it was coercive. I mean, I think it's clear from the record. I don't know how many times she said, I'm pretty sure. I think if I go back in there, I'm just going to get pushed into saying guilty again. If we read through the series of interrogations that went through with the judge, the DA, and defense counsel. And I want to go back to simply to this court needing to clarify the purpose of the statute. You know, this might have been a public nuisance. It might have been disorderly conduct. And even if he didn't actually urinate, I mean, the evidence is essentially as susceptible to an innocent explanation as it is to a guilty one. And there are maxims in the law that permit him to get the benefit of that doubt. Relieving oneself at 10 p.m. in the back of a parking lot, it's just not a sex crime. and he shouldn't have to register as a sex offender. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. This matter will stand submitted, and the court will be in recess.
All rise.